Blog Talk Radio.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
We still hold certain truths about African Americans to be self-evident. That the phrase 19th century black Americans refers to enslaved people. That New York State before the Civil War denotes a place of freedom. That blacks in the New York City designate Harlem. That the black community posits a classless and culturally unified society. That a black elite did not exist until well into the 20th century. The lives of Peter Guignon and Philip White belie such assumptions. They were born free at a time when slavery was still legal in New York State. They lived in racially mixed neighborhoods, first in Lower Manhattan and then after the Civil War in Brooklyn, and at a time when Harlem was a mere village. Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for joining the show. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And also, you can send me an email if you have a question, concern, comment about any of the guests or shows, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. I just read from Black Gotham, A Family History of African Americans in 19th Century New York City. You got to pick up this book. I am so excited this morning. I am just so, I'm on the ceiling right now. I'm about to introduce the guest, but we just had an awesome 5 minutes of chat and realized how serendipitous it was that she is on the show this morning, today, this date and time. I'm very present today, I want to say, because I'm so excited about her book, the detail, the time, the brilliance of the people in the book, the history is so important. So I want to welcome this morning Professor, author Carla L. Peterson. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
So we were just talking about it took you 11 years to write this book. I mean, how did you maintain the strength to keep going and to complete the book?
I'm just a very persistent person, and once I make up my mind, I don't move, and I just work until it's done. And one of the reasons I wanted to do it was to add, to contribute my part to the story of Black Americans in the 19th century, and a story that didn't have to do with slavery. But the other part was to find out about my ancestors. Just knowing so little, so few family stories. And in the first week when I found something that just gave me the courage to go on and to believe that I could find more and more. So it was just so much fun to go into the archives and find out more about my family.
Well, some of the places that you went, we mentioned about the Schomburg Center in New York City, and I mentioned to you earlier, I had Dr. Khalil Gibran Muhammad on talking about the Schomburg Center and also his book, Condemnation of Blackness. It's a wonderful collection. If anybody is in New York, has a chance to go to New York, check out the Schomburg Center. They have wonderful programs, options for researchers such as yourself that went in. It's just a wealth of information. Talk to the audience a little bit about going to the Schomburg. Actually, you know, I want to read a little bit before you even start. I want to read. This is from the beginning of the book. It's talking, it says, "What caught my eye was the long, skinny column on the right containing the obituary of P.A. White, clipped from the February 21st, 1891 issue of the New York Age." Talk to the audience about the New York Age and what that was.
The New York Age was a newspaper started really in the 1880s. It was first named the New York Globe, and then the New York Freeman, and then the New York Age. And the editor was T. Thomas Fortune, and he was a black Brooklynite. He'd actually been born in slavery and come up north. He was not a native-born New Yorker, but he was a newspaper man, and he started this newspaper. And newspapers reveal so much information about our lives, and the obituaries are just always fascinating. Obituaries today are wonderful. They tell us so much, but I think in the 19th century, they tell us even more.
Well, definitely, because as you mentioned earlier in the book about how difficult it was, well, first of all, I think psychologically, as African Americans in this country, we think maybe there is not information available to us, that people were not concerned about preserving our history. And in trying to get history, we sometimes hit brick walls, and one of the things you talk about is how in families, nobody wants to talk about the past. And why is it that they don't want to talk about the past? And is it because of trauma? What's the case? Is it because they don't want to let you know about certain relationships that people had? And I mentioned to you how I tried to interview my grandfather, and he was like, well, I don't, what do you want to know? And I'm like, well, Papa, you know, I want to, like, you know, what's your favorite ice cream? Or, you know, where did you want to travel before you die? Or, I mean, just things, you know, and he didn't want to talk about it. And I was like, what the heck? And then after he died, I found a picture. He is standing in front of the Taj Mahal in India. What? You know, talk to me about your family and the silence that you felt, the silence that you felt was passed down to you.
My family was no different from yours or that, I think, of many, many African Americans. And I really don't quite understand why, because the history of my 19th century ancestors is really a fabulous history. But I was given very little. And, of course, when you're a child, you're not that curious. You don't ask. And I think by the time I was old enough to ask, people were no longer around or they were incapacitated mm-hmm. and couldn't talk
yeah.
about it. But
yeah.
as children, we don't ask that much. But I was given one story which turned out to be half right and half wrong. And it was that the man that you mentioned in the obituary, Philip Augustus White, was my great-grandfather. And I had been told that he was born in Haiti and that his name was Philippe Auguste Blanc, so a French name, that at the time of the Haitian Revolution, he went to Paris, became a pharmacist, and then moved to New York and anglicized his name. And the name is right, that he was a pharmacist and in New York, that's all right. But the Haiti business and the going to Paris, not at all. And so when I was giving a talk the other day, somebody asked me about the romanticization of family history and this tendency to romanticize. And so in addition to the silences, and I think the silences have much to do with not obviously wanting to talk about slavery, because it turns out that Philip's mother was a black Jamaican woman. So she mm-hmm. was either a slave or the daughter of a slave. And I think that there's a reluctance not to talk about that, obviously. And so what happens is that the silence gets filled with kind of a romantic history.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned also in the book about rituals, that how important they are within the family, within the community, within, you know, the nation, that we have rituals, and that the lack of rituals is sometimes what causes history to slip away, slip out of our fingers. Do you remember any particular rituals in your family that were done?
No, I don't. And I really thought mm-hmm. back, and I thought long and hard, and I just couldn't think of anything. But it's possible that there are rituals that happen and we just don't know them. You know, we don't recognize them. And the family doesn't say, well, this is what your mother, your grandmother used to do or your great-grandmother. I think that in the family, a ritual can be so obvious or just so assumed and so accepted that it's not even thought of as a hand-me-down from the past, if you will.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It wasn't like officially denoted that this is
exactly.
you know, the
exactly.
ritual, you know.
Right, right.
Well, one of the things you bring up is in the book about talking about 5 points in New York. And as I mentioned to you earlier, I had Charles Fuller, Pulitzer Prize-winning player, Charles Fuller on the show, and he has a children's book, and he also talks about 5 points. Tell the audience a little bit about what 5 points is and who lived there.
5 points is an area of Lower Manhattan It's near what is Center Street today, and it was the convergence of several streets, Anthony Orange, Cross Street, I don't know, and five streets came together in a single point. And in the early part of the 19th century, it was filled with an incredibly mixed population. So the important thing to realize is that Harlem, from the quote that you read, was a mere pasture. And black New Yorkers, like everybody else, started out in lower Manhattan, then gradually drifted northward. So you have in Five Points a mix of white and black, of poor, of not so poor, of immigrants, of native-born population, et cetera. And it was known as kind of a den of iniquity, as a place of incredible poverty, squalor, mm-hmm. Prostitution, stealing, theft.
Speakeasy, type of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And yet, and the most famous description we have is by none other than Charles Dickens, who did a tour of the United States and wrote about the different places he went to, and he has an entire chapter on Five Points. And every other writer afterwards picks up on his description, and it is just that description of squalor and horribleness. But the fact is that not my family directly, but many of their friends and blacks who considered themselves part of the elite, as educated, who had trades and so forth, live there too. And mm-hmm. what really I find so upsetting is so many of these depictions come from a white perspective with white voices. And I was never able to find a black person writing about Five Points from, you know, their home.
From an internal perspective.
Mm-hmm. Right, from a black perspective. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the great things about your book, and we mentioned also earlier in our brief conversation about positive history, reaffirming in the midst of, you know, cholera, in the midst of, you know, war, in the midst of mob, you know, you can't even travel up and down the coast. So many positive things were still going on with African Americans, and that's one of the beautiful things that makes your book such a gem. One of the things I just mentioned about the cholera is that, you know, even African Americans were blamed for that. Let me just read a little bit about from your book. It says, New Yorkers still blames blacks for outbreaks of epidemics. Racists held them responsible for the virulence with which cholera ravaged the city. It was blacks' moral deformity and gross stupidity, their filthy habits and ignorance of proper hygiene, that had made disease so difficult to control. Yet, your book also notes, reformers and public health officials were somewhat more sophisticated in their thinking. They were slowly coming to the conclusion that personal behavior was perhaps not the direct cause of the epidemic. So it was really more related to the social conditions in the neighborhoods, which they still didn't clean up, you know.
Right.
I do have a caller. Let me see the question here. Good morning, caller. You're calling from 718 area code. Do you have a question?
Yes, good morning. Hi,
good morning.
This is D. Burt, the Afro Nerd, my own show on Blog Talk.
Hi.
This is very coincidental that I had just purchased Dr. Peterson's book a few minutes before your show. And I was just Googling it. It was so funny. So I'll tell you one thing is that just a question to the doctor. Do you think there could be greater inroads in informing black folk about the black elite? I know that what's the gentleman's name? He wrote Our Kind of People. He wrote a book about
Lawrence Otis Graham.
Graham,
yeah.
Correct.
Graham,
It seems that we seem to be hesitant about really showcasing or highlighting these people, and I don't know why that seems to be the case. You think it could be any inroads in informing us?
Well, that's why we're having the show today, because I'm trying to highlight.
But I mean, in a general sense,
you know,
though.
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that class is still such a vexed question in our community. And the reason why I wrote this book was really to try and examine the idea of class in greater depth, and to, because what happens is that people think of the elite as so sophisticated and not wanting to mess with the folk or the masses, and I mean almost being race traitors. And what I try to point out in the book is, yes, they were privileged, they had a good education, they made money, they lived well, they ate well, but that they remain race men and women. And through every single decade of this century, so when slavery still exists in the South, they are fighting, they are active abolitionists. When in post-Reconstruction, the 1880s, when the promises of emancipation are falling apart, are disappearing, they are struggling with national politics, you know, and trying to intervene with the Republican Party and even with the Democratic Party. So I think that if we're more open and look at the vast array of living conditions, from, you know, living well in the home to professions to political activism, that is a way that we can kind of break down this idea that, you know, the elite is, you know, bougie and therefore horrible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for your question. We have about 14 minutes left. I just want to try to move on with the interview, but I do want to thank you for listening to the show. And again, if anyone else has a question or concern, you can call 646-929-0368, or you can join us in the chat room and just type in your question there. So I just want to encourage you to do that. And also, you can email me before and after the show, during the show, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com, to learn more about Professor Peterson's book and upcoming shows, or if you just have a question. One of the characters that really jumped off the page for me, I mentioned that to you earlier, was Garnet, and I want to read a little bit about him. This is a person in the book. Garnet's courage and perseverance during this period were all the more astonishing, given the severe physical disability under which he labored. Shortly after returning from sea, Garnet had contracted a swelling in his right leg. Crippled and in constant excruciating pain, he was eventually forced to have the leg amputated. Travel to Canaan and to Troy had been hard enough for Crummell and Sidney, but it was almost unbearable for the sickly Garnet. "I can never forget his suffering," Crummell wrote with barely suppressed anger in his eulogium. "Sufferings from pain, sufferings from cold and exposure, sufferings from thirst and hunger." But one of the things that you also mentioned was his mental prowess complemented his physical manliness, he was just a bright light in terms of his presence. And one of the incidents that happened to him was that someone threw a pumpkin at him, and he made this quote, I highlighted it. It says, "My good friends, do not be alarmed. It is only a soft pumpkin. Some gentleman has thrown away his head, and lo, his brains are dashed out." So he had a sense of humor also, this character. Just tell the audience briefly about Garnet.
Garnet is a fascinating, fascinating character. He was born in slavery in Maryland, and his father brought the family, in a covered wagon, to New York City. And they were living there, and he went to school with my great-great-grandfather, the Mulberry Street School, and was brilliant from the get-go, right from the beginning, and recognized as such. So the family didn't have very much money, and so he went out to sea as a sailor. And while he was away, kidnappers came from Maryland to try and get the family back, to take them back into slavery. And kidnappers were known as blackbirders.
Blackbirders, yes.
Horrible phrase or horrible word of, you know, the idea that we are, as people, are blackbirders, are blackbirds, and so they're blackbirders.
Mm-hmm.
And the family narrowly escapes, and when Garnet gets back and finds out about it, he is so angry and so upset. And I really think that it's this incident that kind of set him on a very, very radical path of black activism, more radical than Frederick Douglass and most others in the period. So the quote that the passage that you read from, he went with Alexander Crummell and a couple of other young black men to schools in upstate New York and New Hampshire. And so what you read was the the people in the town not wanting them, these young men at the school, and they're having to leave and go elsewhere. So, and he's lost a leg, and so you know, the horrors of that. And the pumpkin episode is he's referring to a student who is protesting the fact that the young black students are there, and he's referring to the man's brain, his head, the Southerner, as a pumpkin. Right?
Yes. So he, had a great sense of humor, you know, that he comes through with that quote, I think. Sarcasm.
Yeah, yeah. And so then really quickly, he's an ardent anti-slavery activist. He becomes a minister. He's a man of the church, but he's a very ardent anti-slavery activist. And during the draft riots in New York in 1863, he's hunted by the mob. Somebody has the foresight to take down the number of, you know, outside his house and maybe his name or whatever, so that the mob really can't find his house. After that, his life after that is very curious and somewhat sad. He founds something called the African Civilization Society, which encourages blacks to go back to Africa. And whites had been doing this for ages. They wanted free blacks to go back to Africa,
yes. Mm-hmm.
to Liberia. And people really saw him as being nothing different. So many in the black community, in the black leadership, really opposed that movement. And he's really marginalized and, you know, at best and at worst, treated with a great deal of hostility by the black community. So in 1881, he finally decides that he himself is going to go to Africa, and he goes to Liberia, and he dies maybe 4 months after he gets there.
One of the things,
I just want to add that you know, in the decade after, the black community in New York recognizes his value. And they try to raise money to build a monument in his honor. They're not able to raise the money, but at least they recognized his worth.
I think that's the key word right there, recognize. And again, that's why your book is so important, because you're recognizing people that have been forgotten for whatever reason, for lack of you know, archiving, because that was a class, a money issue. You needed to have money to purchase items or save things or store them and protect them and all those things. So, again, your book is so important because you're highlighting these things that are people and places and incidents that have been forgotten, again, slipped through our fingers. I want to quickly, we have about 7 minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about white benefactors that help different people and family members. We talk about, in your book, you talk about the Loreland, the tobacco giants. Tell the audience a little bit about them.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the other things I tried to do in the book is really examine race relations in New York in this period. And it's very clear that race relations are terrible. New York is a very pro-Southern city. Mainly because it's a commercial center, and New York merchants have very strong ties with the South and also with the Caribbean. So that is kind of the baseline out of which all black New Yorkers operated. But what I was interested in is, other than this systemic problem, to try and tease out personal relationships that might have occurred between blacks and whites during this period. So I came upon the Lorillard family, and they're a very wealthy tobacco merchants. They're two brothers, George and Peter. And I was astonished just to find out that over and over again, the way in which they'd had contacts with whites that were really that were really quite positive and quite beneficial to blacks. So
yeah.
the first thing I found out is George sells lots of lands to a group of black families on Center Street, and provides a lease of the land on which St. Philip's Episcopal Church is built. And the other thing he does is to help this man named Peter Ray, who is a family member. And he, Peter, I found a record, I think it was through the obituary, saying that Peter Ray entered the Lorillard Tobacco family, a factory, as a errand boy when he was 11 mm-hmm. years old. And
yes.
by the time of his death, he was a superintendent of the new factory in Jersey City. And they recognized, they kept him on as an employer because they recognized his worth. So we're back to that word, worth. And I found a note, totally by chance, in the New York, in a little book in the New York Public Library, a manuscript, saying that what they valued about him was that he was a great judge of tobacco and he could choose leaf according to whether it was for snuff or for chewing or for smoking or whatever. So mm-hmm. I was just so impressed that that the Lorillards really recognized black skills, valued them, and rewarded them accordingly.
Yeah, and you also mentioned about the work conditions, that theirs was far above any other in the area. Maybe,
yes.
you know, maybe in for African-Americans to work for them, so it was a good place. We only have about 3 minutes left, but quick, some other important people you talk about was the hairdresser Toussaint. You got to pick up this book, people. You need to pick up a copy of the book. I can't even tell you all the wonderful stories, and it's just, it'll make you, you'll have a good day after you read the book. So you need to pick up a copy of Black Gotham by Carla L. Peterson. But let me read real briefly. We only have about 3 minutes. This is from near the end of the book, and your mouth might start watering. The dinner itself is a masterpiece of the caterer's art. I'll reprint the menu for those of you who weren't able to join us. Oysters on the half shell, mock turtle, green style, fish bass with lobster sauce, cucumbers a la Commodore, the entree, chicken croquette a la Victoria, roast bone turkey, mushroom sauce, petite pies and potatoes, sweetbread patties a la Reine, Roman punch, cigarettes and olives. Okay, this was a menu. Okay, this was a menu from one of the societies that Professor Peterson talks about in her book. I think this was the New York and Newport Ugly Fishing Club event. Yeah. And so there were societies of African-Americans, and they were having these elaborate parties with these elaborate dishes. These are things that people are not aware of. You know, people were thinking of all African-Americans being in squalor. You know, so I think that, again, your book is just wonderful, beautiful. I thank you for doing it, taking 11 years to do it. and, you know, one of the things, oh, you know, we didn't even talk about Madison, Wisconsin. Real quick, tell them about Madison, Wisconsin. And
okay, I want to say one thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to
mm-hmm.
say one thing really quickly. So these people are having this fabulous meal, but afterwards there are speeches, and one of the speeches is, of what value is the Republican Party to us? You know, should we think about going to the Democratic Party? So along
mm-hmm.
with this elaborate eating, there is, you know, really difficult race work being done.
Serious conversation. Yeah, and definitely. I mean, this is, you know, but I just wanted to highlight again, we talk a lot when we deal with African-American history about the struggle and the trauma
right.
and things like that. I wanted to highlight
right.
a positive moment that
yes.
they were
yes.
able to create, at least in a small time period, this a place of peace amongst
right.
the trauma, amongst the conflict.
Right. Right.
But again, that's another reason people have to pick up your book, because there's so much in there that we can't even get. But Madison, real quick, Madison, Wisconsin, you were out there. What were you doing in Madison?
Okay, so my great-grandfather, Philip Augustus White, became a pharmacist. He had a 2-year apprenticeship in the pharmacy of James McCune Smith, eminent black New Yorker, and then his obituary says after that he goes to the College of Pharmacy of the City of New York and gets a diploma in 1844. And somebody said to me, you can't trust obituaries, you need to verify this. So I hunted all over New York City for the records of this College of Pharmacy and couldn't find them. And I was about to give up, and I thought, one last try. And I called historian of American pharmacy, I think a man at Ohio State, and he said to me, well, you know, the best pharmacy papers are at the Wisconsin Historical Society. And, well, no, I didn't. So I hopped on a plane and went out, and I found the records, and I found the whole mention of my great-grandfather and the fact that he went there, that he graduated in 1844. that the men that he graduated with became
Professor Peterson, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry, Professor Peterson. I'm going to have to cut you off.
Okay.
But everybody, go out to Madison, Wisconsin to learn more about the history of pharmacy. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I want to thank the listeners for listening. Go follow me on Twitter.com/JoyKeith. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keith. Have a wonderful Saturday and have a wonderful week. And again, thank you so much, Professor Peterson, for coming on this morning.
You're quite welcome.
Have a wonderful Saturday.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.